Thank you. I'm Michael Carrier from Rutgers Law School. Thank you for inviting me to be here. Thank you for looking at this very important issue. And most important, thank you for putting off your lunch long enough to hear from speaker number 17 out of 17. It is really impressive to hear from so many people in such a short time.
Congratulate our staff. That's
good. So what I'd like to do is talk about seven things in 10 minutes. I submitted a one-page outline. I don't know if it's available, but what I'll first do is talk about why this is such an important issue. Second, talk about why rhetoric has affected innovation here. Third, fourth, and fifth, talk about three asymmetries that further reduce the role of innovation. Sixth, talk about some legal applications. And seventh, talk about a couple things the committee could do. So first, this is a vital and important topic. Why? Because I wrote a book on innovation and law last year. I've spent the last decade thinking about patent, copyright, and antitrust law and the relationship between those laws and innovation. And what I concluded in that book was that the patent and the antitrust laws, even though they get so much negative attention for ignoring innovation, have actually done a pretty good job. The patent laws in the last decade, the antitrust laws in the last generation, at better internalizing innovation, so they are in better shape. In contrast, copyright law has ignored innovation, and that's why my proposals for copyright are so radical, because copyright has not considered it, and as a result, there is a significant adverse effect on innovation. Second, what role does rhetoric have to play? Well, the debate these days is one that occurs along the lines of theft, of piracy, of absolute property. And when you have a debate on that field, it is not likely to be a nuanced debate. Take property, for example. Property is very limited. And back when I was a younger scholar and a little more ambitious, I looked at the 50 limits that occurred in property law. And any property scholar can tell you that property is not absolute. Property is limited. However, when the conception of property is exported to another field like copyright law, all of a sudden it becomes an absolute property that nobody can do anything with. So again, add property to theft, to piracy, to this obsession with business models. Yes, technologies will adversely affect the 20th century business model. But again, as we've heard this morning, that's not the goal of copyright, to prop up the old business models. Rather, it is to foster innovation and creativity. Marry that with the fact that there's panic upon every introduction of a technology, and we see how the debate has not been the most conducive to innovation. Third, what I call the innovation asymmetry has further pushed innovation down in the analysis. The innovation asymmetry I refer to is one that looks at the infringing and non-infringing uses of a dual-use technology, one that can be used for infringement but also for non-infringing purposes, and says that courts tend to overemphasize the infringing uses and underappreciate the non-infringing uses. Why is that? Well, with the infringing uses, you have something that can be calculated. The copyright holders can come into court and say, here's exactly what we have lost through downloading. The copyright holders have every ability to conduct those studies, and they have every incentive to conduct those studies, given that their business model is coming under attack. In contrast, the non-infringing uses do not have such a privileged purse. So for starters, we have the fact that it's tougher to put a dollar figure on this. How do we calculate the benefits to innovation, to communication, to entertainment from non-infringing uses? It is much harder to do so. You're not dealing with a calculation like we have on the other side of the scale. We also don't have a party that is so vested in bringing this to court. Less of an incentive to do so, again, more dispersed throughout the culture and not an incentive to bring it forth like the copyright holders do. And finally, all of the benefits of a technology are not apparent at the onset of the technology. Inventors themselves don't know the uses to which the technology will be put. And I talk about a whole bunch of examples in my book. I've supplied three chapters dealing with copyright to the committee, so they're available if you're interested. And just a few examples here. You have Alexander Graham Bell, who's saying that the telephone was designed to broadcast the daily news. You have Thomas Edison thinking that the phonograph would be used to record the wishes of old men from their deathbeds. You have railroads, which were designed to be feeders to canals. I could go on, and in the book I do. The point here is that if inventors themselves do not know the use to which their technology will be put, how could we possibly expect courts to know with certainty? I think that's very difficult. My next point is what I call the error cost asymmetry. In writing a book on intellectual property and antitrust law, I thought it might be fruitful to take ideas from one field and apply them to the other. In antitrust law, there's an interest, some might say obsession, with this notion of error cost. That's the cost of erroneous decisions. So it's not just getting it right, but rather the costs that occur if we get it wrong. And in antitrust law, there's really this focus on false positives. The worst thing in the world is to take a defendant that is innocent and find them guilty of violating the antitrust laws. So I thought it would make sense to apply that concept here in the area of innovation and copyright. And what I found was that the false positives here are extreme and very concerning. Why? Because if you have a technology, say a dual-use technology, that is put out of business from a court decision, then we will never know what that innovation would have led to. We will never know the ripple effects that will reverberate through society. So the false positive effects are extreme. In contrast, the false negative effects are more muted. Why? Because the technology will be allowed to continue. There might be a little extra copyright infringement, but we could always deal with that after the fact. So when you look at error costs, I would say that that's another reason why there is innovation that has not been sufficiently appreciated in the analysis. My next asymmetry is what I call the litigation asymmetry. Regardless of what the law is, regardless of error costs, just the process of litigation is one that is not very conducive to small technology holders here. Frequently, we have large copyright plaintiffs here. We have getting together or ganging up in litigation. We have 30 companies, 28 companies suing Grokster, suing Replay TV. And you have small companies that go bankrupt as a result of the litigation. Even if they have the best defense in the world on the merits, they can't really get through the entire process because it is so difficult and so expensive, and so unfortunately they need to go out of business. So what do we do with all of these observations? My proposals are basically two in nature. What I have time for today is first dual-use technologies. I recommend going back to Sony. Sony asked if there was a substantial non-infringing use. I think that that is the most conducive to innovation. I think that other proposals that have been offered are less conducive. When you look at inducement, when you look at tests that make it more and more complicated, that does not make litigation something that these small companies can survive, and so that's why I urge a return to Sony. In terms of statutory damages, I would recommend the statutory damages be eliminated for cases of secondary liability when it comes to technology manufacturers. You look at the sheer amount of statutory damages, $150,000 for each work performed on the device. There could be thousands of works on the device, could lead to, in one of the cases, $37 billion in statutory damages. Is that some sort of proxy for any of the harm that's suffered? I don't think so, but rather it pushes the parties to either settlement or bankruptcy, and so that's another proposal that I would recommend. In closing, I think that the committee can do a couple things. First, the committee could make clear as a policy matter that innovation deserves a seat at the table. With copyright infringement today, innovation really is forgotten. And so just to make clear, and I think by the proposal of what the committee is trying to do here, I think this is something that's possible, to make clear that innovation must be considered is something that would be extremely useful. And finally, evidence would be something that's useful as well. As we've gathered this morning, the committee is correctly trying to find evidence of stifled innovation, or at least certain things that we could put on the other side of the scale, and I think that would be something that is very useful to do. So I'll close with the parable with which I began my book. I began my book with the parable of someone who lost their keys and is looking under the lamppost. They look under the lamppost not because they lost their keys there, but because that's where the light is. And that's what happens with courts today. Antitrust courts look under the light post of price. Copyright courts look under the light post of infringement. And that innovation lamppost, which is most important for the economy, unfortunately does not have a lot of light coming from it. It's tough to put our finger exactly on what we have lost, but to the extent that this committee can enlighten us on that issue, that would be extremely helpful. Thank you for your time.